Do you remember when you first expressed an interest in music, Carol?
Well, one of my earliest memories of music, I sang in the church choir for years, but really a vivid memory for me is being at Center Island with my family. I think I was about 6 or 7, and it might have been during Caravana. Anyway, I can vividly remember eating a snow cone that one of the performers had gotten for me and sitting on a stage eating the snow cone with all these people dressed very colorfully and in these big outfits and stuff. And there was music, had been playing on the stage. This was during a break. But I had actually gone missing. My mother couldn't find me, and she found me sitting up on the stage with all these performers. So I guess it was something that, was in my blood from an early age. And I can remember just going to see skating events, figure skating shows and things, and always just thinking, gee, I want to be the person skating. So I think I just had a desire to be a performer from an early age, yeah. Yeah, and I think I feel very comfortable with, colorful kinds of people that aren't afraid to say what they think and to be slightly different from the pack, Although it's funny because my friends tell me that I'm quite conservative. I don't know.
Do you come from a musical family?
Well, there was a fair bit of music. Music got played in the house via, records and things. But not really. My dad was an accountant during the day, and then he would moonlight and do some DJing at night. So he would often set up his DJing equipment on the weekend because he was getting ready to do a gig and play, all kinds of different styles of music. Not really much that I particularly liked, I don't think. He also played a lot of opera, which I really hated as a kid. I didn't like it at all. I have much more of an appreciation for it now. But, as a kid, you're thinking, ooh, what is this stuff? But we did, I had an uncle that was Barbadian, and he lived to be 93. And as he got older, I guess I actually asked him if he would leave me his piano. So, and he did. When he died, he left me his piano. So I inherited a piano when I was, I was probably about 9 or 10, and started to take lessons. But unfortunately, I didn't persevere. I mean, I got to like grade 4 or 5, but really I never practiced enough. I wasn't disciplined, but I'm still trying to learn to play the piano now. But anyway, wow. It's a lifetime goal of mine.
What are your top 5 recordings that you really, really enjoy listening to?
Well, the Nancy Wilson Cannonball Adderley record is definitely a Desert Island record for me. She's one of my strongest influences. And then Cannonball Adderley, amazing playing. I would say Ella Fitzgerald, maybe her Clap Hands, Here Comes Charlie record. Miles Davis, Kind of Blue, has to be in there with that band and the soloing and just the way that unit works. And I guess that was really quite groundbreaking at the time. And it just still sounds beautiful today. You put it on, it's kind of timeless. It just sounds fresh, which is remarkable because it's quite old now. Then I would choose Johnny Hartman with John Coltrane. It's a small record. He sings Lush Life, Dedicated to You, You Are Too Beautiful, Autumn Serenade. I think there's just 6 tracks on it, but it's really beautiful. And I think that's the quintessential, vocal recording of Lush Life is Johnny Hartman singing it with John Coltrane.
What a voice he had.
Oh, unbelievable. And Coltrane,
it's
the combination. It's just, again, it just sounds incredible and timeless. And then one of my all-time favorite records is Shirley Horn's Here's to Life. It's absolutely gorgeous, just eloquent. The string arrangements were all done by Johnny Mandel. And I believe that the folklore, I'm not positive about this, but I understand that she would only record that if she could record the tracks with her trio ahead of the strings and everything being added after the fact, so that the string arrangements were written around what she and her trio were doing and her phrasing and everything else. So I believe that's true, which is kind of remarkable. And it's just such a beautiful record.
One of my favorite vocalists was Shirley Horn. Now, you had a chance to actually see her.
I was lucky enough to see her with her original bass player and drummer before her bass player died. And I remember reading an article where she said, I think she had part of her leg amputated due to diabetes as she got older. And they were asking her about, you know, that whole thing. And she said, well, losing my leg wasn't nearly as bad as losing my bass player. I think because she stretched the time so much, too, like both as a friend but also musically, she stretched the time a lot. And he was one of the few guys who could sort of watch her left hand and knew her well enough and knew her phrasing well enough to know where to place the beat with her. So the article went on about how much she missed him, both personally and professionally.
So, Carol, when it comes to singing, who are some of your influences?
Nancy Wilson, for sure, probably one of my strongest influences. Ella Fitzgerald, I've sort of gotten more interested in scatting over the last few years. And so she would definitely be somebody that I've been listening a lot to for that and just for her tone and phrasing and, you know, just a gorgeous singer. Shirley Horn as well, wonderful, swings like crazy, incredible phrasing. Renee Lee, I love Renee Lee, and I've been to several of her workshops and have had a chance to meet her and talk to her a fair bit, and I'd love to study with her at some point, but she's in Montreal, but still, it's not so far away. Tony Bennett, I used to listen to a lot of Tony Bennett. Really, really love Tony Bennett, and again, you know, the phrasing and his tone and just the overall style is so, so there. And I've seen him perform about 5 times live. I've been so lucky. And he's just incredible. And I even got a CD signed, so I'm happy about that. And then another person that I've listened to a fair bit, I need to get one of her newer records, but Diane Reeves. I think she's quite a remarkable vocalist, both in terms of her phrasing and tonality and pitch, and also the scatting is really pretty incredible. She's pretty amazing. I think she's probably the hottest thing happening now would be Diane Reeves.
Outside of vocalists, what else are you influenced by?
I just did a radio show with a friend of mine, he said, come and play an hour's worth of music with me, you know, and we'll talk about that. It was actually 3 hours of music, and he said, yeah, bring some CDs, and almost every track was a vocal track. But I am influenced by instrumental records too. But, you know, I guess I've just done so much singing over the years, and I've been on bandstands with so many, I've been so lucky to be on bandstands with so many incredible soloists that really my professional life almost takes care of that. So I find that if I have a bit of time, I'm listening to more of a vocal recording just to stay ahead of that, you know, because I still get to enjoy the beauty of soloists around me all the time, you know, on gigs, which is great.
If there's only one artist that you would love to record with and even perform with, who would that be, Carol?
I think I'd love to do a duet with Tony Bennett. I mean, that would be incredible. I'd love to do a duet with Tony Bennett. And I was just at the IAJE conference here in Toronto, the jazz conference, and Quincy Jones spoke at it, and Quincy Jones also spoke at the Oscar Peterson Memorial Concert, which I was at, and I think he would be a wonderful guy to work with as well. So either one of those guys would be incredibly fun to work with.
Your thoughts on Oscar Peterson?
Well, there'll never be another one like him, I don't think. Just, you know, an incredible all-around player, could just play anything he decided he was going to play.
Do you have any memories of him?
You know, the only time I really met him, and this is a bit of a regret for me, and I don't have a lot of regrets, but the only time I met him was he was being brought into the Hall of Fame in Mississauga, you know, or the Hall of Fame, or they were giving him the key to the city or something like that. This is a few years ago, and I was invited to go to that, and so I actually did get a chance to meet him and shake his hand, but I should have tried to see him a whole lot more than I did. But yeah, just an incredible musician, that, you know, we'll probably not see the likes of him for a long, well, never another one like him, you know. Yeah, just incredible.
Let's talk about your album, A Night in Tunisia. How long did it take you to record that album?
We recorded that record in about four-hour sessions. I had the bigger band tracks. I had most of the guys coming in. It was like a year ago, January 3rd, 5th, 7th. That was the first block of work that we did. They were four-hour sessions down at CBC, and starting, you know, not too late afternoon. And so the first 2 days, the 3rd and the 5th, I did all of the bigger recordings. And I had, on the second day, I remember that on the 5th, I really started to feel the pressure of having both Guido Basso coming in and then Peter Apodaca. So the 5th, and it's funny because I know Peter quite well and I know Guido fairly well, but just all of a sudden, I remember we went in and, because we had actually recorded the track A Night in Tunisia the day before, but I wasn't happy with it on a couple of different levels. So I rearranged things and asked Guido Basso to come slightly later in the day, and Peter Appleyard, and we went in and we recorded A Night in Tunisia again because I didn't like the take that we'd gotten from the day before. And it was great. It was bang on. We just needed to be fresh. We'd left it till too late in the day, and it was, it's a mouthful. It's in 6 and then it's in 4, and it's all over the place. But we got a great take on that, which was good. And then I knew that Guido was coming in, and I started to feel fairly tense. I have to admit, I really could feel the pressure of those guys coming in. But they came in, and they were great, and they were seamless, and it was easy, and they were, you know, in a good mood. And we got our day, which was probably about 4 tracks that I wanted to get that day. And then I had, a couple of days later, I went in, 3rd, 5th, so I went in on the 7th with Dave Young. Dave and I were up first, and we recorded that there very quickly, which was great, which was just a duet. And then John Sherwood came in, and we did Every Time We Say Goodbye, because by the 7th, I was pretty tired, like physically sort of tired. So that's all we did. That's kind of all I had planned, and that's all we did. And then we just listened to a few other things from the other days to make sure we got everything. And then I decided sort of after the fact that I didn't have John McLeod on the record anywhere, and he was kind of a strong mentor of mine, and I really kind of felt strongly that he should be on the record somewhere. So I added him to a duet that I had done at Mohawk College for a concert where I worked with Jeff Young on guitar. We did a rendition of You Don't Know What Love Is, which was kind of cool. It worked well for this concert. So I thought, well, that's a no-brainer. That'll be a neat little, you know, something mm-hmm. different, which I'll put on there too. And I invited John McLeod to come in and sit in on that. So that's pretty much how we recorded it. It was all pretty quick. Like I knew I was very well prepared, and I knew that I wanted to get almost all of the tracks, if not all of them, live off the floor. So we just went for it.
When it came to producing the album, you had a chance to hire the services of the Pattersons. How did that come about?
I had worked with Dennis Patterson on Bob Bruff's Spring, Like a Spring Day.
That's right.
On the Bob Bruff Like a Spring Day. I had worked with Dennis Patterson, who had produced that with Bob. And I really enjoyed working with him. And every time I came into the studio, things were comfortable, and we just started to record. And I didn't even feel like I was recording, and I could hear myself well, and I could hear the band well. So I had already had that in my mind when I was doing Like a Spring Day with Bob Bruff. I thought to myself, and I think I even mentioned it to Dennis, I said, you know, I'm going to do my own project in about a year, and I'm really hoping that you'll be able to work on it with me. Now, Dennis Patterson actually went to England and lived in England for almost a year. So as soon as he came back, Bob Bruff said, you know, he's back in town, and I called him and we started to, you know, organize how we would try and do this. So I had that in my head from early on that I'd like to make a record of my own with Dennis Patterson.
Was it difficult for you selecting songs for the album?
Not really. Although that it is tough. It's tough to know really what to do. So I actually didn't think about it that much. I chose tunes that I felt really comfortable with, that I felt I could do almost anything with, and then I was smart enough to put the arrangements in the hands of John Sherwood, who did a great job of breathing new life into some very standards. He basically did exactly what I wanted. So it was great.
Over the years, many artists, not only vocalists, but musicians as well, instrumentalists, have recorded standards. Now, what is it about standards that's so captivating and that is so fresh for performers to perform them year after year?
They're very well written, I think. You know, I mean, I think they're just very well written, beautiful melodies with wonderful lyrics. And I think there's a certain kind of innocence to the lyrics a lot of times, which are not, that's not really present in tunes that are being written right now, not so much. I think it's an innocence of a time that's already gone by. So there's something kind of beautiful about that. And then, you know, they can be reharmonized to sound like almost brand new songs. So you have the skeleton of something already that's, you know, pretty much perfect. And then you can just put your own slant on it through, you know, some reharmonization of chords. And then, of course, your own take on the tune.
Let's talk a little bit about how you selected the musicians for your album. Was it a challenge or did it come easy to you, Carol?
It was pretty easy, actually. I wanted to work with people that I'd worked with over the years that basically I just felt really good with. So that would be musically and personally. You know, you don't want to be in a studio under, you know, a fair bit of pressure, feeling like you're not being supported or that people are second-guessing what you're trying to do or any of those things. So I was really lucky enough to work with these, you know, this like super A-team Toronto guys, and mostly I worked with them through Peter Appleyard and doing concerts with Peter over the last 20 years. So, I mean, initially, and even now, I really have no business being with those guys because they're so incredible. You know, they tolerate me. And but particularly when I was about 20 and I was sort of thrown into working with these guys, it was amazing. And see, I had no idea who they were. So I managed to actually sing. Had I known who they were, I probably would have been in big trouble. So Dave Young has been quite a great supporter, you know, and I always enjoyed working with him, and I just loved the way it sounded when he played. So I knew that was, you know, I was going to try and make that happen. And the same thing with John Sherwood. I met him a little later in the game when he started to work with Peter Appleyard, but I felt the same way about him. And then Reg Schwager, also same thing. Had met him originally with Peter Appleyard. And Terry Clark was in New York for quite a while, but then once he came back up to Canada, he started to do a fair bit of work with Peter, and I met him through that. I also met him through Bob Bruff and working with Bob Bruff's quartet, because Terry works quite a bit with Bob Bruff nowadays. So we had done some gigs that way. And then, of course, Bob. I wanted Bob on sax. And I've done a lot of work with John McLeod and Chase Sanborn. I knew that I wanted to have Chase. So really, I kind of rounded up a lot of my friends and people that I felt had been kind of mentors, you know, just so that I would be comfortable as possible, so I could just do my work and not have to think about anything other than the song. And also just the caliber of the musicianship of all of these guys. I just knew I'd have nothing to worry about.
What's your favorite song off the album?
I'd say it would be a toss-up between That There and You Don't Know What Love Is. You know, they're really in the moment and not a lot of thinking going on, and I like that.
Do you use a vocal coach to keep your voice in shape, not only while you're performing, but also regularly?
Not really anymore. I'm not studying with anybody at the moment. I have thought over the last couple of years that it would be good to find somebody that I would, you know, occasionally go down and do a bit of singing with. I did study with Gloria Farrar for many years, and then we lost her, and then I studied with Bill Vincent, and he's also no longer with us, which is a drag. And I studied with Seth Riggs, who's kind of a big vocal guru in Los Angeles, but he's a long way away. I mean, I'd love to study with him if he was somewhere closer, because he was quite amazing. But I know there are good people in Toronto, and I may over the next couple of years, although I stay out of most of my bad habits, because I teach a bit now, too. So I think by reiterating a lot of stuff to my students, that helps me to stay out of falling into bad habits.
I understand that you do some teaching as well. How many students do you have?
Well, I teach at Mohawk College, and this year I have, I have eight private students. And then I teach a small ensemble once a week, where I have six or seven singers get up and sing with a trio. And that's a fun class.
What other projects do you have on the go for the rest of 2008?
I'm going to do a tribute to Peggy Lee on January the 21st with two other singers, with Irene Atman and Kinga, a girl who just goes by one name, Kinga. Great name. Mm. That's on January, that's Monday, on January 21st. That's Sound of Toronto Jazz Series tribute. And then I fly to Seattle on the 26th, and I'm singing with the Tacoma Symphony on January 27th. And then I'm back in Toronto, and I work with, I'm really honored to have been asked to sing at the tribute to Oscar Peterson at the Living Arts Center in Mississauga on Valentine's Day, on the 14th of February. I was really thrilled to be asked to do that. And then March 14th, I will be at Brock University with John Sherwood and Guido Basso, and I think Terry Clark and Neil Swainson's joining us, Reg Schwager. So that's going to be a great concert. And then March 26th to 29th, I'm doing a small tour in South Carolina, just three nights down there and then back. So that's, you know, the first part of the year going by anyway.
Are you going to be doing any performing outside of North America?
Nothing in the works at the moment, although it looks as though I might have something. Someone's interested in my record from Japan. They're interested in distributing it in Japan. So who knows? Maybe I'll end up going to Japan. That would be fun.
Carol, what are you listening to these days?
Well, as I was saying, I was just at the IAJE, the big international jazz conference, and heard Kurt Elling there. So I bought his new record, Night Moves. It's really interesting. He does a new version of Body and Soul. So they use the existing chord structure to Body and Soul, but it's a brand new lyric and really kind of beboppy. It's really interesting. So I'm listening to his record and the new Tierney Sutton record, who was also at the IAJE. I've got a Bill Mays recording that I got from Terry Clark that Terry's playing on. And Nancy King. Have you heard of Nancy King?
Beautiful.
She's got a record out with, Fred Hirsch on piano.
And oh, man. Must be nice.
It's an all-duet live record. It's quite remarkable.
You mentioned earlier on that you played piano. Do you play any other instrument?
I studied viola. I played viola all the way through high school. I was in the orchestra and really played quite well, but I haven't had one, held one, you know, in 20 years. But it's interesting because my husband wanted a violin for Christmas, so I got him a violin. So I've been playing that just a little bit, just having a bit of fun. I'd rather be playing a viola, though. I like the tone of a viola better.
Do you remember your very first performance as a jazz singer?
You know what? I'll bet it was a concert with Peter Appleyard. Sure, it was a concert with Peter Appleyard, and I was, you know, probably flinging around some standards and sort of very haphazardly. I'll bet you anything. I would think that would be, and I would have been in my 20s.
There's an album that you performed on a few years ago entitled Like a Spring Day. How did that all come about?
I had done a lot of work with Bob Bruff. Over the years, we've ended up on a lot of bandstands together. And he approached me to sing some of his tunes. And so we started to do that on live gigs. And then he said, you know, I'm going to put together a whole record of my original tunes, and I'd like you to to be the voice on the record. And I said, oh, wow, that'd be great, you know. It was a fabulous quartet. So that's pretty much how it came to be. He approached me and started giving me his originals, and I learned them, you know, bit by bit. It took me a while because they're, you know, mostly unusual tunes and tunes that I'd never heard. No one had ever heard. So that took a while to get that one together, but it was well worth doing, and I think it worked out well.
What was the most memorable concert that you've ever seen?
I saw Keith Jarrett in the summertime for the Jazz Festival this past summer, and that's definitely one of the best concerts I've ever seen. He was incredible with his trio, and apparently he was in a very good mood, which doesn't always happen, I understand.
That's right, yeah.
He was very happy and just played his head off and did two or three encores, and it was gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous at the Four Seasons concert hall. It was fabulous. I loved it. Oh yeah, it was just seamless, you know, seamless. He played a lot of ballads that were gorgeous, you know, Someday My Prince Will Come. He played Straight No Chaser, which was cool, very up. It was a great concert, just a great concert. And I would also say I saw Shirley Horn during one of the jazz festivals. That would be, you know, 12 years ago probably. And she was remarkable also with her original trio. That was another great concert.
Recently I came across a revelation of sorts. I was featuring the music of Shirley Horn on my show, and it struck me how much that Diana Krall was influenced by her her vocal stylings. Do you care to comment on this, Carol?
Yes. And in fact, Diana Krall credits her as being one of her greatest influences. I think that the thing that makes Diana Krall so great is, which is something that also made Shirley Horn so amazing, was the beautiful phrasing, like a beautiful tone of voice, beautiful phrasing, and then that combined with the way the piano then comes in and takes the melody. It's almost like having two instruments in one. It's, you know, and it's seamless, right? Because it's all the same person accompanying and singing. It's gorgeous and really unique phrasing. I mean, I think both of them have very unique phrasing.
Carol, thanks so much for dropping by today. It's been a lot of fun.
Hey, thanks, Randy. It's been great fun.